I hope everybody had a good weekend, and that I want to say to the to Bob Nicol, what a great presenters that you brought to us on the panel last Thursday, and what a good job you did. So what I'd like to do is start off with Mr. Britton. At least I remember your name this time. And you can give us a preview and have some remarks. And then I just want to ask the committee again if you'd be patient with us. And let's walk through the House Bill 5031 with as much brevity as we possibly can, so that we can hear our panel today. And that's one thing I like about this committee. You guys have been so good and so understanding that when Oregonians come to testify, we really give them time to do that, and we need to apply that again today, as much discipline we can along those lines, but at the same time asking the needed questions that you need to ask in order to be supportive or non-supportive of the bills that are before you. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Members, I wanted to briefly go through the week ahead with you. There's an agenda for this week. As you can see today, we're going to be continuing with a budget presentation on House Bill 5031, the Department of Human Services budget bill, specifically the addictions and mental health services component of that bill. We'll continue that tomorrow. And then on Wednesday this week, we are scheduling public testimony for the public to come in and talk about this bill in support, or if they have concerns about it. That's what Wednesday is for. Thursday, specifically, we're going to be looking at the state hospital, the state mental hospital, and getting some more detailed information on the plans for that. If you flip the page over, next week we have tentatively on our schedule Senate Bill 5534, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, on Monday, March 26th. We have scheduled a time for public testimony, or will schedule a time for public testimony on that bill on Monday. On Tuesday, it's our hope that this subcommittee will have a work session on Senate Bill 5534. Deborah Manthey is the LFO analyst who has responsibility for that Senate bill and the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Then on Wednesday and Thursday of next week, we'll continue with the DHS budget bill, House Bill 5031, and the medical assistance programs. The other thing I wanted to mention to you, members, is that the department asked us to hand out a further appendix to your notebooks. It was behind this orange sheet, and it should be put in the back of your notebook related to addictions and to mental health services. So it's Appendix D, and Appendix D is the Community Services Workgroup report for the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. Some of you, perhaps all of you, know that the plan for the Oregon State Hospital, rebuilding that, is premised on the fact that there will be sufficient community services provided to those in need of mental health treatment, and the whole Oregon State Hospital assumes that those services will be in place. This report is about all of that, and I highly recommend it to you. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it back to you.
Any further comments from members of the committee before we get started? This is a good time. Thank you very much. With that in mind, I'd like to call Mr. Nicol up. And then I'll ask you, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Nicol, and I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services and responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And joining me is Eric Lohr. Thank you again for your attention last week and appreciation, especially for the attention to the panel that we had. I thought, too, it was very moving. And I think, as I said, I've been in the business almost 40 years, and I never tire of hearing the stories. We didn't get as far in some of the performance outcomes and key performance measures. So what I'd like to do, with your permission today, before we get to the panel of people interested in mental health issues, so that we can get that discussion kicked off, we'd like to start on page 12, talk very quickly about the performance measures. Key performance measure 19, I don't think I mentioned that one. Eighth grader risk for alcohol and drug use. We use the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey as the data source for that one. The current target is 30%. It has risen by 22%, and so currently 39% of Oregon 8th graders are using alcohol and other drugs. You'll see 32%, I think, in some other places. That's the figure for just alcohol use in the last 30 days. But 39% of our kids in the 8th grade report to us in a pretty reliable scientific sample that they have used alcohol or other drugs in the last 30 days. When we talk about the need for prevention, and we look, for example, at the state of Washington, it's looking much better, 18% just above the border for alcohol and drug usage, alcohol usage in the last 30 days. It's maintained its funding for prevention over the last number of years. We haven't, and we would submit it's showing. Other performance outcomes that we will be talking about in the next couple of days come from something called the National Outcomes Measures, and I'll try my best not to use acronyms, but NOMS is the term that sometimes I may slip into. But the federal government has been working with the states in both the addictions and the mental health area to agree upon measurable, meaningful outcomes that we can use to do better cross-state comparisons. And we in Oregon have felt supportive, comfortable, and feeling like we're in a good position to move forward with measuring the kind of things that the national outcome measures.
Dr. Nicol. Colleagues, this is an important area for you when it comes to performance measures, so feel free to jump in on this one. Now, are you working with the drug partnership people, and they are doing research as well with our 8th graders? And how is that working?
Madam Chair, the Drug Partnership, if you mean Oregon Partnership,
yeah,
based in Portland, but a statewide prevention organization, yes, we work very closely with them. They're a major statewide prevention contractor, and we'll probably be hearing from, in fact, I know you're going to be hearing from them in public testimony, but we work very closely with them.
So some of the successes that you're talking about in terms of the measures you have here is coming from your partners as well, or is this just specific measurements that the state has done?
The national outcome measures are things that all of the states around the country are working toward agreement with the federal government about. A lot of this ties into the federal block grants for addictions and mental health. And so that's really the source of the discussion and the sources of the negotiation. That was the point when this is agreed upon enough, and I think we've gotten pretty close. We pass those expectations and those outcome obligations on to our providers through our contracts. And I think that's really the relationship to the providers like Oregon Partnership.
So do we have dollars that are specifically geared toward measuring Oregon's kids? Because when I look at it very holistically, when we start talking about teen issues as it relates to suicide, as it relates to the mental health, as drug and alcohol abuse, and that whole kind of continuum, if you will. And I was just wondering, do we have anything that is specific to Oregon's youth?
Madam Chair, I believe it is policy option 107, but I'm going a little bit by memory. As for funding for regular funding that we don't have to carve out of each agency budget each session for the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey, that's the basis for a lot of the measurements around prevention issues. So,
okay.
So the governor's recommended budget does have money in there for that.
Thank you. Senator Marchette and Representative Nathan.
I read a study, or I heard of a study, that says there are more 8th grade girls drinking than boys Are you familiar with that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, that's part of what we're hearing from the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey over the last several years. The eighth grade girls are actually out drinking eighth grade boys in terms of 30-day usage. More eighth grade girls are drinking now than eighth grade boys.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about how it is we determine or estimate how many of these young people are using alcohol or drugs and how often they do. There's the Healthy Teens Survey, but we all know that some surveys, depending on the audience and the type of question, some people answer surveys in a way that they think people want them to answer, or they're trying to hide something or trying to demonstrate something to be cool. You know, so could you talk for a moment about what you think the reliability or efficacy of that survey instrument is? And then also, could you please explain to me how Washington collects its data so that are we really comparing apples to apples in this 18% versus 32%?
Madam Chair, Representative Nicholson, the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey is the product of quite a few years of planning and then implementation. It was, I think, originally brought up by some university-based researchers, and the questions are carefully crafted. It's been tested for reliability. I can't give you detailed technical information, although I can get that for you. Dr. Tony Biglin, who may have testified before the legislature on different occasions, is one of the leading people on this. Dr. Mel Cohn in public health is also very involved. Our office is involved, and we can get you more information on the reliability and validity. Those are questions that have been asked about this particular survey, and based on the presentations that I've heard recently, I'm confident that it's about as good as you can get, but there are always some caveats that you're raising. I will have to go and check to see what survey instrument the state of Washington uses. I'm assuming for now that it's comparable, but I'll get information on that for you, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would think it's comparable because the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey is our version of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that all other states are doing. So I think I would assume that they have similar questions. And ours is self-reported through the schools.
On that particular survey. So Children First help with that?
Sure. We use their data heavily. Children First heavily use their data because that is the main source of information on youth issues in the state.
Children First does very good research, and we've come to rely on them a lot in terms of grooming Oregon and its children. Further questions? Thank you, Dr.
On page 14, you'll see a graph of perceived risk of drinking that's also based on the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey. And as you can see, the trend has been that teens are seeing drinking as less, alcohol and drug drinking is seen as less risky. That's not a good trend. It doesn't seem to me like a good time to relax about these issues. In the governor's recommended budget, there's included a $3 million policy package. This is in the OLCC package. We are proposing to spend the money on increasing the use of community coalitions where they're not already in existence and increasing those. And then we would work through our county mental health and addiction systems to implement a program called Strengthening Families, SFP. This is an evidence-based program, and in addition to implementing this, we would implement a meth component that's been tested and found to be successful in the state of Iowa. So those are the outcomes that we would expect from that particular policy option would be decreased family conflict and stress, decreased child depression, I'm on page 17 now, decreased substance abuse among parents and children, improvements in family environments and parenting skills, and increased pro-social behaviors in children. So those are the kind of outcomes that we would be building into our contracts and monitoring and being able to report back to you, and I believe that if we use evidence-based approaches, will report back the kind of outcomes that are expected.
Madam Chair, Senator Corley.
Thank you. If I may inquire here, given the question that Senator Morissette asked earlier about the increase in girls' use of alcohol. Will you be in your grant-making process, will you be looking for strategies that are targeted to this population, explicitly targeted to the population?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, we've already started that. We have a federal source of funding called Enforcing Underage Drinking Laws, and we, for the first time, executed a contract with an organization called, Girls Incorporated, and it's especially focused on that, and as we get a little further into that, as we get data, we'd be happy to report the effects of that, but we recognize that this is something we have to focus on in particular.
Very good. I'm very pleased to hear that you're working with Girls Incorporated, such a dynamic, empowering organization. Really excited about their work. The other thing I wanted to say about Senator Morissette's comment is that we do have the opportunity in this session to look at funding overall for girls in a number of categories, because we're still faced with an imbalance or a lack of equity in funding programs and services for girls. So again, I really appreciate that Senator Morissette picked up on that, and let's continue to have that conversation and awareness.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we will, in fact, one of the speakers later will be talking about some of those issues from a personal family perspective.
Great.
Moving on to page 19 is the alcohol and drug treatment section. This is a well-educated committee, and I'm not going to walk through all of the details of services provided or exactly how we organize them. I will just say that we're serving fewer adults now and fewer children than we did a couple of years ago. We had significant cuts, as you all know.
And that's bad news.
The thing that I want to, you can see the numbers there, 56,432 adults and 7,060 adolescents during fiscal year 2005, 2006, and then 2,056 people received problem gambling services. If you don't mind just looking ahead to page 21, you'll see what I think is pretty disturbing signs, that we serve only 35.6% of the adolescents and children that we believe are in need of public services. Now, many services are offered in the private sector, so all I'm talking about here are the public sector. It's not a good thing when we're only serving a little less than 70% of the adults who need public services, but to see that we're only serving 35.6% of adolescents is a telling statement.
Just one other question, Doctor. When we look at these numbers, when, because I think colleagues, it happens to tie in with the piece that Representative Kotek has been talking about, and I've been concerned about, and that is having more children stay in home while the state helps deal with drug and alcohol problems for parents. So this 68.9% takes in consideration those people as well, Doctor?
Madam Chair, yes, it would include that. If you'll page forward to page 22, you'll see that child welfare is noted on one of the bar graphs there, child welfare, return custody. We do relatively well if we can get those families into treatment, but the problem again is the lack of access. And one of the governor's recommended budget packages includes, and this is again in the OLCC funding area, would allow us to serve several thousand more families so that we can get their kids back home to them and get those families back functional and working. And again, those are the kind of outcomes that we're looking at. I know in years past we've presented a lot of what I consider to be proxies and well-researched proxies for the success of alcohol and drug treatment, and we show them to you, I think, somewhere in here. I'll locate it in a little bit. But I think what we're really trying to move to is even more concrete kinds of outcomes, like returning kids to their parents, employment, getting kids kicked out of school less, all of those kind of really concrete everyday life things. We know that we're not the only factors that influence those things, but we have to be a part of it, and the discussions that I'm having with our alcohol and drug and mental health community providers is that they're willing to step to the plate. They've been real troopers about stepping to the plate on the evidence-based practices bill, and I know that they're willing to step to the plate on these kind of outcome issues. Just so that it's on the record, key performance measure number 18 for alcohol and drug treatment is the completion of alcohol and drug treatment. Oregon has actually done very well in comparison to other states. It's currently 73%. Nationally, from what we've been able to determine, the completion rate for alcohol and drug treatment services is 51%. Methodological questions, I think, are good to ask there so that we know for sure that we're comparing apples to oranges. But I think a 73% completion rate is not a bad rate. I think we'd like to see it be at 75%, and that's the target that we've set.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. What is it, Layton said?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Both of you.
It's good to see that we can get people into treatment. You know, most of them get to completion. I wanted to just ask you about the effects of the cuts in Oregon Health Plan, particularly the standard population. We lost a lot of parents there. Who are on the health plan and they don't have access to AMD, and how that's affecting our community. I've heard from public safety people saying that's one of the number one issues for public safety in the community, because people don't have access to treatment because they've lost the health plan. Do you have any numbers or anything you'd share with the committee about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, our analysis shows that we lost about $25 million a year in treatment, or not per year, per biennium, in alcohol and drug treatment. I think I recall providers telling me that they lost 68% of their operating budget. We did a survey and we learned that as a direct result of the OHP standard loss, we lost about 1,000 AMD workers and 1,000 mental health workers. So the impact was dramatic. We placed this on the record, I believe, two years ago during the session. Obviously, during that time, we were still struggling with a real depression in the state economy, but I think it's important that we remind ourselves now where we were, what we've lost, and that the budget, although it's moving in the right direction as far as I'm concerned, it still probably doesn't get us back to where we were before. We virtually eliminated waiting lists for all levels of care. We have much better access to intensive outpatient care, and those things are real problems. Now, and the reason for that was that a lot of adults were Medicaid eligible by virtue of income, and it turned out that they had a surprising, maybe it shouldn't have surprised us, but I don't think any of us were quite prepared for the amount of alcohol and drug problems that were in that relatively low-income population.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we were able to restore parts of standard, do you have any sense of how that would have an cost the system? Could we get the money lost back in the system? I'm just wondering if you've done any analysis if we can buy back some parts of standard, how that would, because I know that's really tough on the nonprofit providers. It's amazing they're still alive and kicking, to be very honest.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I don't know if we've done a specific analysis of what the governor's recommended budget would bring back in the way of A&D treatment services, but I know we could do that, and we'd be happy to research that next couple of days and bring that back.
That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
In some of your statements, you are very careful to point out alcohol and drug and mental health treatment. And in some ways, it might sound like I'm jumping ahead to the next section, but what I'm going to raise with you is a question about it. Does the department have any plans to consolidating alcohol and drug and mental health treatment in presentations and in the way you figure out what you need and in the way you deliver services and allocate budgets? And here's some of my thinking around that. We have heard in some other venues that 50% or better of the people with alcohol and drug problems also have an underlying mental health problem. problem, and that unless you treat the mental health problem, you will never make a permanent change or permanently help, or it's very difficult to permanently help someone who's getting A&D treatment. So then when I look at performance measures or statistical information that you provide, for example, 73% completion rate of alcohol and drug treatment, that sounds real good, but do these people stay well beyond a year or two later, or do some of them need to return for treatment again and perhaps again, or do they perhaps fail at some point and then not return to treatment? And is it because of lack of resources then to provide mental health services? I'm starting to sense a systemic problem in the way we address the issue comprehensively for some persons.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, we've known for 20 years, beginning with the research from Tom McClellan at the Philadelphia VA, that the people who are less likely to complete alcohol and drug treatment are the people with mental health issues. They don't necessarily have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, but they have some kind of diagnosable mental health condition that makes it much more difficult for them to complete. Oregon was one of the first three states in the country in the mid-80s to have what we call the dual diagnosis task force. And we didn't do it quite good enough, so we had a second one that we issued a report in 2000. That was in part what led up to the recombining of mental health and addiction services at the state level into an integrated office. I think the level of concern among alcohol, drug, and mental health providers about too quickly blending things and losing advocacy and losing important things was high enough that it's taken a couple of years for us, I think, to get to the point where we can have a really focused discussion about what it would mean to have integrated services. I directed our staff to put together an action plan, which we have now, on co-occurring disorders. Included in that is a white paper that they've completed on funding, whether braided funding, as we mentioned the other day, or purely blended, or what kind of funding approaches should we have. And I'd be happy to share that with the committee so you can get a better glimpse into what the office is doing about the very issue that you're talking about. We're very concerned about it, and I think now have an action plan that moves us, that will move us forward.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative?
I do. Thank you. I would like to hear more about it and for the whole committee to hear about it. And if there's something legislatively that we need to do to help nurture this improvement, in my opinion, it would be an improvement. I would really like to see it and encourage it. But to the extent that you have more information at a later time for us, I would like to hear it.
What I would offer to Representative Nathanson, as one of our newer members, is that your voice is most welcome and you are joining a conversation that has been in progress. Thank you for raising that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kotek.
No, and I just agree.
Senator Morissette.
Well, for what it's worth, we have had an alcohol recovery fee for the last four sessions that would help fund alcohol, drug, mental health treatment from the source of the problem, for what it's worth.
I have a couple of questions for you as the chair takes back. Thank you. What are the opportunities for the federally recognized tribes within the budget for the policy option packages, and then anything else that would help our general awareness as it relates to the federally recognized tribes? What should we be aware of? And then I have another question.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have a contract for a full-fledged community mental health and addictions program with Warm Springs. That's been a statutory option that they exercised a number of years ago. I'd have to go back and look exactly when. couple of sessions ago, that opportunity was extended to some other tribes. It used to be that you had to, I think the bill was fairly specifically crafted to Warm Springs, where you had to have reservation land in more than one county. That the legislature changed that. We now have the option of contracting for full community mental health and addiction services with other tribes. We've had discussions with Grand Ronde and a couple of other tribes about that, but we haven't gotten to the point where they really wanted to step forward and take on that full set of services that would be required. We're going to continue to have those discussions. We also have alcohol and drug contracts with, and prevention contracts with all of the tribes, all the nine federally recognized tribes. And I think it's a critical issue. We also have a direct contract, as you know, with Native American Rehabilitation Association, which is the urban Indian organization that I think does an incredibly good job of working with Indians who are not part of tribes or not part of reservations. And, we have recognized the major challenges that the tribal communities have in this state. I mean, one of the most sobering statistics I've seen is that about 74% of Native American men between the ages of 18 and 65 have alcohol problems. That's a staggering statistic and something that we recognize to some degree in our contracting process now.
Sometimes, colleague, you don't give people kudos, and I should tell you, after being here since 1985, Dr. Nickel is the first administrator in terms of mental health that have worked with and recognized the tribal work that we do, and I want to give you kudos for that, Dr.
Fair question?
One additional question. It has been interesting to me over the last several sessions as we have focused, as we should, on the methamphetamine epidemic, that we did not pay attention to, in this setting, did not pay attention to the crack cocaine epidemic, which is still with us. And I'm wondering, has anyone in the department looked at the social, economic, other impacts of the crack cocaine epidemic within certain within specific populations in Oregon? Have we done that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Gould, I think you're raising a good question that because of the prominence of the methamphetamine epidemic, I'm not sure if we paid enough attention recently. Now, I'll go back and ask staff if there's some data that I haven't seen that I've missed that speaks to this specific issue, and I'd be interested in that. But I don't have a quick answer off the top of my head, so I will go back.
And just to follow up and conclude, my overarching concern is one about disparate treatment or the failure to look at issues that impact communities. You know, in the case of crack cocaine, we're talking about impact on people of color, African Americans, other people of color, and our failure to elevate an issue and give it the same or the prominent attention that we've seen given to the methamphetamine issue. And I'm only raising it now because this is the time to raise it, but also I'm recognizing that Senator Carter has raised the issue over many years, and Senator Winters has raised it since she came into the legislative assembly as well. Mm-hmm. And I just want to put that back on the table. It's like whose voice needs to be raised before the subject is paid attention to.
Madam Chair, I neglected to mention that in the Governor's Recommended Budget Policy 103-39, alcohol and drug equity was a $4 million piece in the Governor's Recommended Budget, and that would go to tribes as well as counties, so that's another piece of the Governor's Recommended Budget that you should be aware of and hopefully supported by as we get to that point. I want to talk a little bit more about policy option 101-7. That's on page 25. I mentioned that we would increase by several thousand. The exact number is 2,664 people to have access to evidence-based alcohol and drug treatment. These are adults who are going through the child welfare process. And we really believe that 60% of the parents involved in child welfare who successfully complete addiction treatment will also regain custody of their children. Right now it's at 50%. And also, as you probably are aware, we're not getting access to alcohol and drug treatment for child welfare involved families. So we need to hopefully see our way through to approval of the governor's recommended budget in that area. In this package is also residential treatment.
Can you hold on for a minute?
Yes.
I just feel this urge and I have to tell the committee this. The question that Senator Gordon asked in terms of crack cocaine was never listed as a policy issue in the state legislature. Consequently, that when most people, the dealer of crack cocaine, they went to jail as opposed to having beds. And that's the difference in the devastation of a community that has no one that writes its policies into state government statutes like we have with methamphetamine. Therefore, many of the parents whose children were taken from them was taken under criminal intent, as opposed to with us putting into statute the issue here. It then becomes a social issue where then we disperse dollars to try to keep more kids in the home as opposed to their parents going to jail but into a bed. Think as you will and process. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to put on the record that 90 adults and their children would have additional access to residential treatment. We have a couple of programs in the state that do an incredible job of allowing parents to come into residential treatment. There's a dad's program in Southern Oregon. There's a mom's program in Lane County, and there are a couple of other, one out in Baker City as well. So this would allow us to expand that level of care, because not all women and men who are in child welfare can get their kids back just through outpatient alcohol and drug treatment. So this is a limited number, but I think it's a critical number for us to consider. Also, in this policy option package, there would be funds to start 14 new Oxford House, we call them recovery homes. These are cooperative living situations that Oregon has really been by far the national leader in developing. We have, I think, close to 150 such homes now, and one might wonder why we would want to do even more, and the answer is clear, because they work really well. And they're allowing families to work with getting their kids back. People who have left prisons have found them very useful as a place to move into the community and be able to live in an alcohol and drug-free environment with a community culture that really says you're here to be serious about recovery from staying off alcohol and drugs.
So, Doctor, do you know that we need to get the civil rights issue resolved before this policy option package goes forward?
Madam Chair, I fully recognize that, and we're working hard with a stakeholder group. We think we've reached a place where we can get enough agreement, but you're right, there has to be consideration to both protecting the home environment and particularly kids. There are 300 kids who live in these Oxford houses around the state now, but also protecting the civil rights of people who might otherwise be made homeless or unfairly evicted. And so it's really, in my opinion, trying to find the right balance between those two great needs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
Very briefly, my experience with Oxford houses in terms of inquiry has been in relationship to halfway houses for prisoners. Now, how can you say there are 300 kids currently living in Oxford houses? And how did the state, I don't understand the mix and match. Are there separate Oxford houses for people on probation, parole?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, now halfway houses are actually a different category of programs than recovery houses or Oxford houses. And so the Oxford houses may have characteristics of halfway houses, but those that have kids in them, as I understand it, are very carefully separated from those that don't.
Very briefly, it's a great program to help rehabilitate people who are released, so they're cuts down the recidivism rate, and that's another issue. But I mean, we need to. And so I thought Oxford houses were basically for that. I was not aware that they were also places where kids went to.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think one of the exciting things about Oregon is that it has 10 times per capita the number of Oxford houses than the national average. And so we've really been out there trying things that other states, just because of sheer volume, haven't been able to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to the 101-7 policy option package, I guess what hasn't been clear to me is, looking at the chart on page 21, we have increasing unmet need, meaning families who are connected with the child welfare system don't have access to treatment. How will this package affect that number? Maybe I'm missing it. I see some percentages here that you're citing, but I guess I want to make sure that, A, we're actually increasing access to treatment and we're not skipping money out somewhere else, because this is increased OLCC revenues that we're using. So I don't know if I'm making my question clear, but are we actually getting more slots?
Madam Chair, yes, we will be getting additional slots. This doesn't supplant anything, and we will work carefully, as we've already started with the planning process with children, adults, and family, to work out the referral processes so that we can assure not only that we get the right people in and the right number of people in, but also that we get the outcomes. And as we contract this money out, everybody understands already that if this money comes through, we're going to be accountable for outcomes. It doesn't mean we'll get every family successfully reunited, but we'll set realistic and good goals for doing that, and I believe we'll achieve them.
Great, thank you.
There's controversy surrounding that amount, and I think that you should know, and that has to do with the fact that the money will come from OLCC, and the cities are a little concerned about that. But I have to tell you, everybody wins when we can keep children in their homes. It costs us approximately $16,500 per child to be in foster care when we can spend a year, and we can spend approximately $3,500 to $25,000 to keeping more children in the home. And so I think that's a policy issue that begs to be dealt with, and we're still working on that. So I need all of your support in terms of prioritizing those dollars. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm looking on page 26, you'll see equitable alcohol and drug treatment package 103.39, $4 million. I mentioned before that some of this money would go to the tribes, the rest of it would go to those counties. I believe there are 13 that are below the per capita funding for the state. Now, let me explain something real quickly here. This is not the full range of alcohol and drug treatment funding. This doesn't include Oregon Health Plan Standard or OHP Plus, nor does it affect residential treatment. This is state general fund money that's there to serve outpatient people who are non-Medicaid eligible. And over the years, and I don't know that it's worth going into all the historical reasons for it, these per capita rates got very skewed. Some counties are very high, some counties are very low. Klamath and Multnomah happen to be on the relatively high side. If we don't have some money to fix this, I feel some obligation to begin trying to equalize the distribution around the state, because some counties, particularly in Central Oregon, Washington County, very fast-growing areas in the state, are so far below that when you look at it, I can't say anything other than it's really not that fair. But it's also not fair, in my opinion, to take money from programs that are doing a great job, and there's no community in the state that's overfunded. So the $4 million would allow us to raise those 13 counties that are below the per capita average up to the per capita average without taking money away from counties.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It really was an odd couple, Klamath and Multnomah counties, both being on the slighted edge in this funding. So these are good pops, Bob, and my congratulations.
Madam Chair, Representative Berard, I've had two senators, one from Klamath and one from Multnomah County, who have had me in their offices and were very unhappy about the possibility that we might have to take money away in order to fix. So I'm very pleased that the governor's recommended budget has a solution for that. It doesn't solve all problems, but it raises the boats that are low without taking boats from that are still struggling to keep above the tide. So I appreciate the governor's recommended budget including this. And finally, in the OLCC funds as well, Policy Option Package 111 has $3.6 million for assuring access to treatment for drug courts. And we recently listed drug courts as one of our evidence-based practices. This makes a great deal of sense to me. You cannot have a successful drug court. In fact, you can't have a drug court at all if you don't have access to the treatment on demand, basically, for the people who are going through the drug court. So that brings us to the close of the packages. The outcomes that you can expect from equitable alcohol and drug treatment are all the kind of positive outcomes we see with alcohol and drug treatment, and that is higher rates of employment, lower rates of incarceration, fewer families stressed, and I could probably go on and on, but I want to put on the record that these are outcomes that I know that we can achieve. The alcohol and drug community, I just want to say this one more time, is already at 54% of the funding goes for evidence-based practices. They only had to be at 25% this biennium. I think that shows that the addictions area, because of involvement with something called Clinical Trials Network and a lot of other research efforts, really had gotten on board with this very quickly, and I think we can have a lot of confidence in the alcohol and drug provider system.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, I'm very pleased with these POPs, but as many other sets of programs, we're digging ourselves out from a hole in the past couple sessions. Do you have a sense of where this brings us back to what we had before, prior to maybe the special sessions in 2002?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we lost, as I said, we tried to estimate that it's about $25 million a biennium from the loss of OHP standard. We also had cuts of, I think, $3.1 million in residential treatment that we never got restored, and there were a couple of other cuts. So my guess is that we lost close to 50% of the capacity overall, but I'd have to go back and do a more scientific loss, look at the loss.
Thank you. Just to follow, I think what's really interesting about it is that we know what works, and if we just fund it, it actually has the outcomes we want. And this is probably the one area where I don't think there's a lot of debate that if we use the right types of programs for people and they can get into treatment, we get what we want, and we get there's the outcomes that we're looking for. So if you have a sense of, I wouldn't mind seeing some historical trend, because I think there's some sense that we're back to where we were, and we're not. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think your understanding is correct, and we'll go back and do that. I know we put together a couple of graphs that I think would help us get this out to you fairly quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you. So you're saying you're driving the bus? Where do we go from here?
Madam Chair.
We have an agenda where we can go from here.
I would suggest we move ahead. Rather than me starting into the community mental health budget, I would like to see us have a chance to have the five panelists have a chance to come up and talk, and because I think that really sets the stage for the more bureaucratic and financial discussion that we do need to have.
Good. Great. So we have a community mental health panel, and mind if I call you up a couple at a time, Jenny Farish and Josephine Cookers.
Okay, I'll go first. For the record, my name is Jamie Farish. I'm a family member. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Farish. I'm a mother of a 10-year-old son, Ezra, who has bipolar disorder. I'm also a foster parent of two children with developmental disabilities and a family involvement coordinator for Clackamas County Community Health, working on the mental health side of that. First, I would like to say how proud I am that Oregon has taken a stand for children with mental health disorders. because of the Children's System Change Initiative and the strong leadership at Addictions and Mental Health, we have finally begun to work together to bring our children home and in their communities. I have worked with families in Clackamas County for the past 4 years. I would like to tell you about one family I've been working with. Their child has been in residential more times than we can count. This family needed emergency and planned respite, behavioral skills experts, and therapy in their home. Before the Children's System Change Initiative, they only had traditional outpatient mental health and residential treatment. The lack of flexible supports led to the repeated institutionalization of their daughter. Now, thanks to the Children's System Change Initiative, they have kept their daughter at home, in her community, and even with friends. But there's still work to be done. Sadly, my own son Ezra has not been so lucky. Because our family has private insurance, my family has been left out, without the supports we need to keep our son Ezra out of higher level care. The last time my son was admitted to subacute at Albertina Kerr and later to residential treatment, we needed the following. We needed emergency respite, behavioral skills specialist to come into our home, and help with our son between the hours of 2:30 and 6 p.m. until we could stabilize him on medications. Because we have left the populations of non-Medicaid eligible children out in the cold, we are still forcing families to institutionalize their children. As a family involvement coordinator, I continue to receive calls weekly from families in crisis with private insurance. I have witnessed these college-educated families quit their jobs, put second mortgages on their homes, max out all of their credit in a desperate attempt to get their child the treatment and supports needed. It is not enough to simply pick up the tab for residential treatment for these families. We are still losing some of Oregon's most precious resources, our future. Thanks to several system of care grant sites in Oregon over the past 8 years and the Children's System Change Initiative, the state is ready to move to the next level. Together with the wraparound project manager and the governor's steering committee, our state will take the next step toward a statewide system of care built on the principles of wraparound, family-driven, youth-guided, community-based, and culturally competent care. In order to effectively guide the state of Oregon in the right direction, we must not only be leaders, but also examples of how to adopt and implement these values. The family leaders across the state need a full-time family partnership specialist position in order to accomplish the goals for a family-driven and youth-guided system. The state must show everyone how to fully include families as equal partners from the top down and the bottom up. There are many families and consumers who have been active participants in the plans and implementation of the new state hospitals. The state should feel very good that we are finally honoring people with mental illness and restoring their dignity. Unfortunately, without money for developmentally appropriate services for transitional youth between the ages of 16 to 24, we are simply lining them up to fill each and every bed in these new facilities. I implore you to focus on transitional age youth and the services and supports they need to live, to have independence, health, and recovery. Transitional age youth have very specific needs that neither the child system nor the adult systems are able to effectively address currently. Family members are filled with hope for the future for our children. We have accomplished much and done great work, but we know that our journey with professionals is far from over. I believe that together we will revolutionize mental health treatment for children in Oregon. We need your help. Please consider the non-Medicaid eligible children who are waiting right now in institutionalized care for flexible supports and services to come home. Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members.
Questions?
Thank you very much. And thank you for your personal testimony.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Josephine Cooper, and I'm a family member. I'm honored to have the opportunity to be here today. I have the deepest respect for your various roles in this process. Beyond my words, you may hear my passion for a cure to the ills that plague mental health services. I hope you'll be able to respond with compassion. During the past 3 years, I have watched as my daughter became unable to continue her role as an above-average single mother and productive worker who often volunteered for school and charitable activities. Unknown to the rest of us, she was hiding a long-standing anxiety disorder and bulimia. She had slowly developed a habit of self-medicating with alcohol. What we've heard described as dual diagnosis. Gradually, the solution became a primary problem. She became homeless, lost custody of her daughter, and began cycling in and out of shelters, treatment programs, and hospitals. I have an education in the history of medicine and mental health, and have spoken to national groups about the vital need for respectful cooperation between law enforcement and mental health professionals. None of this expertise prepared me to stand helplessly by, hogtied by privacy and commitment laws, as my daughter was repeatedly assaulted on the street. Each time, in her fragile condition, she would courageously make her way through the maze of voicemails on the list of shelters for battered women trying to find one with a room. When and if she succeeded, she would eventually fail the no-drinking policy and was released into the street to appreciate the consequences of her actions. She was assaulted again and again and has probably incurred an average of $200,000 per year in charitable emergency room, hospital, ICU, and ambulance costs for mental and physical trauma. The Portland police responded numerous times with admirable professionalism and compassion, but they were working from the same tattered list of resources as we were. My daughter has been completely without income for several years. She regularly receives unsolicited applications from the Oregon Health Plan, completes them, and is denied on a regular basis. She is finally receiving help from one of the few treatment programs that operates on the harm reduction model, which has some tolerance for relapse and provides 24-hour counseling services. These are three points I would like you to consider. Some of them have already been talked about. Studies support that addiction in women takes a different form. It happens sooner, takes longer to respond to treatment, and is often complicated by association with physical trauma, and also includes anxiety and eating disorders. These women do better in programs that do not place them in group counseling situations with men and dedicate special attention to rebuilding relationships with their children and family. This model of gender segregation does not take into account the realities of domestic violence in gay, lesbian, bi, and tranny communities. However, it is a statistically supported fact that most violence against women comes from men. 2, Oregon needs more treatment programs for women and men with dual diagnosis that include residential and outpatient housing, chemical dependency treatment, and 24-hour counseling services. These programs must move away from the retributive model that has zero tolerance for relapse. If the setting cannot accommodate or manage the client's behavior, there should, at the very least, be a mechanism for referral to an appropriate alternative program. If, indeed, relapse is an anticipated part of the process of recovery, vulnerable women and men should not be released to the street to be repeatedly assaulted and traumatized as they try to make their way through this process. 3, there must be more attention and funding for alternative programs for men and women. This will require imagination and research to create and staff alternative programs that can accommodate more challenging cases. There's a critical shortage of facilities in Oregon and America that operate on the harm reduction model. Acupuncture programs have been proven effective in the treatment of addiction. They should also be reinstated. There's one primary thing you can do: increase budget allocation for the services I have described. Commitment laws have granted the liberty of choice to our vulnerable citizens who have mental illness, but what choices do we offer them with our crumbling social services? What has happened to the promise of deinstitutionalization? I think the answer might be that the promise has been broken through defunding of supporting services and proper oversight of these services. During the cold weather in December, I saw a woman come into the only remaining walk-in facility in Portland. She was crying, exhausted, and dragging behind her a large set of yellow luggage that contained all her belongings. The staff member helped her with the burdens and listened to her as she cried out that she was frightened because she was 60 years old, the same age as I am, schizophrenic, and did not have a place to live. He sat with her. looked directly into her face and held her hand and told her he would help her. By this man, by his manner, he let her know she could take all the time she needed to let out the grief she held inside. We take head counts of the homeless. When we take the time to listen to their stories, we will arrive at new solutions. We need to reinstate a monthly stipend for single individuals until they can negotiate the Social Security application process, strengthen legal assistance for low-income people, set aside funds for facility and staffing of the community health centers that were vital to the vision of deinstitutionalization, and substantially increase funding of critical residential and outpatient treatment and housing for mental illness and chemical dependency. Being ready for treatment does not mean being ready to get on a limited list for an uninsured bed or to be greeted by a bewildering array of voicemails. Give these vulnerable individuals an opportunity to return to their families and to productive lives. Healthcare programs that focus on children are good, but someone needs to be healthy enough to take these children to the dentist and the doctor. This means health care for their low-income mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, and yes, grandparents, too. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions? Thanks. Tyrone, Bruce, and Kevin. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Excuse me just for a minute. Mr. Waters is my constituent, and I want to welcome you today.
Thank you.
He's also the son of Senator Abel Gordy, and so we're glad to have you here tonight.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my testimony is going to be brief. I'm not going to be allowed to be here the rest of the week to testify before you, so I want to get everything said today while I'm here. So please be patient, and I'll try to keep it as short as possible. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tyrone Waters, and I am a consumer advocate of the mental health system. As well, I serve as a board member on the board of directors at Oregon Advocacy Center. I'd like to say that I was a patient at the Oregon State Hospital, and as such, I experienced horrific treatment and abuse by staff and by another patient who was sent to the state hospital from the Oregon Department of Corrections prison system. I was physically assaulted on Ward 48B by a male staff person, Lou Kronberg, and received injuries to my legs. I filed an Oregon State Police report against that person, as well as file a grievance with the state hospital. I was also physically and sexually assaulted by an Oregon State Hospital patient and Department of Corrections inmate, Richard Dickey. I was refused medical care in both incidents, and staff covered it up. My mail was also withheld, and my phone privileges were taken away. These are a few incidents that occurred, as well as racial overtones, while I was at the state hospital. There were staff, however, that were helpful to me while staying there, but let us not forget Corey Dennison, a patient that was sexually assaulted by a male hospital staff and filed a grievance that was covered up by hospital staff. Most recently, there was another set of incidents involving patient Corey Dennison, who was physically assaulted on Ward 50F and received 28 stitches after having been assaulted in his eye by another patient and then transferred to Ward 48C, where staff are not allowing him to file a police report with the state police and not responding to his filed grievances with the hospital and denying him the right to petition the courts for a habeas corpus petition and writ of mandamus for injunctive relief against the state hospital. Over 3 weeks ago, Corey mailed correspondence addressed to myself and a separate letter mailed to Oregon State Senator Abel Gordley, none of which have been received. It is apparent that staff are withholding his mail. Shame on the legislature for allowing the sign to be displayed in front of the state hospital that reads, "People Helping People," when it should say, "People Hindering People." It is my recommendation to this legislative body to implement immediately alcohol and drug prevention programs, inpatient and outpatient community-based programs for conditional release and placement of patients into the community from the State Hospital Forensics PSRB program and wards. Let's stop the stalling on this issue. And I ask furthermore that the legislature order the superintendent at the state hospital and his subordinates to improve, increase, and implement multicultural diversity and awareness programs for patients and staff, and not a program that is just talked about by hospital officials to this legislative body, but one that is a reality and real model that we can see working in the system. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did not sue the state of Oregon for the horrific treatment and abuse and atrocities that it caused me, but I am here before you today and on behalf of patient Corey Dennison to speak out against it. I swear under oath that my stated testimony is true and accurate to the best of my ability. Thank you for your time. I sincerely hope you will give attention to these mentioned issues. Very respectfully submitted this 19th day of March, 2007. Sincerely, Tyrone Waters. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have my written testimony here in case there's something wrong with your video recorder or audio recordings, and I'd like to submit that now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Grard.
Madam Chair, I know I sit here as every committee member does, Tyrone, and thanking you for testimony, your testimony here today. Madam Chair, I would look to you for directions to what this committee can do in action to respond to Mr. Waters' complaints here today.
Well, the first thing that I intend to do, Mr. Chairman, and this Representative Grard, is to immediately ask the Department of Human Resources to send a letter to the governor asking for an investigation. And I don't know how the committee feels about this. If there's something you want to do as a committee, I know I'm going to do it, but if you'd like us to do it as a committee, then I'm all ears. I'm open to your whatever your suggestions are in terms of a committee. Your pleasure.
Well, I would certainly join you in that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Certainly.
I too would join you.
John, I'd like you to have a letter directed to the governor immediately calling upon the director of Human Resources to do an investigation regarding the claims that have been made here today.
Thank I shall do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Waters.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Brooks, and I'm a mental health therapist at Yamhill County Mental Health. One of my roles at the county is as a counselor and case manager for our Assertive Community Treatment Program. Assertive Community Treatment, or ACT, is an evidence-based practice. It was started approximately 30 years ago by a group of doctors in the Midwest, but is relatively new to Oregon and was initiated in our county just over 2 years ago. The criteria we use in order to be eligible for ACT is for the individual to have a serious and persistent mental illness. primarily, we are looking at those with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, and bipolar disorder, and who have experienced one or more psychiatric hospitalizations in the last 6 months preceding referral, or who have experienced at least 3 hospitalizations within any previous 12-month period of time, or who currently reside in a state hospital. In addition, they've been assessed at being at risk for rehospitalization without intensive ACT services. Hospitalizations and jail days are very expensive to the state and are psychologically damaging to some of our most vulnerable citizens. Due to the symptoms these citizens experience, there is a strong tendency to isolate and feel disconnected from society. What ACT provides is a great deal of structure and support that can help them integrate back into and feel part of society. ACT is designed to create independence and has a great deal of flexibility to increase or decrease services based on the need of the client. Some of the services we provide are in-home therapy, case management, and medication management. We assist with issues of budgeting. We call creditors. We go to the bank to resolve problems. We work on areas of nutrition, assess medical needs, and have often accompanied clients to doctor appointments. We assist clients in attaining employment, coordinate with providers for housing, and communicate and meet with family members.
Would you excuse me just for a moment?
Yes.
We have approximately 14 minutes left, and you need to divide your time with your audience with you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. We can do things from traditional sit-down talk therapy to taking them shopping in order to prevent a panic attack from such an experience. In order to provide these services, we have a team that is made up of a psychiatrist, residential staff, an employment specialist, a supervisor, nurse, and case manager therapist that offer part of their time to the ACT team. Caseloads are designed to stay low in order to provide intensive services. 2 years ago, we had a client, and I'll name her Sarah, who within a 6-month period of time was in the hospital 3 times and in jail twice. She was constantly causing problems in the community, and there were questions whether or not she would ever be able to remain out of a hospital setting. We provided her with highly intensive services, and in time, she became stable. In July, it will be 2 years since she has been in the hospital. Today, she is working, has stable housing, and is vice president of Champion Team, which is a consumer-run program. Approximately 2 years ago, Lori came to our county from the state hospital. She had several hospitalizations and spent time in jail. Like Sarah, we provided her with a great deal of structure and support. It has been roughly 18 months since she has been in the state hospital. In May of 2006, she regained custody of her 11-year-old daughter. She is employed, has stable housing, and she, too, is one of the board members of Champion Team. I appreciate the funding that has been given to programs such as this. They are effective in saving the state money through reduction in hospitalizations and jail days. They are also humane and allow a very vulnerable population to be in the least restrictive environment as possible. As the state looks to continue to reduce hospitalizations and bring people out of the hospital, I believe more funding will be needed to address these needs. Funding programs such as ACT will save the state money and provide these clients with the services they need to function. I thank you for the work that you are doing and for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Nubbin. I'm the EAST Program Coordinator in Yamhill County. The EAST Program, the Early Assessment and Support Team, is a program of Yamhill County Mental Health and is centrally coordinated with 4 other EAST County programs. EAST is an evidence-based practice. Our mission is the early identification and intensive treatment of individuals in the community between the ages of 15 and 30 who have had psychotic disorders, that is, extreme and profoundly disturbing psychiatric experiences involving confused thought, hallucinations, or delusions, and who have had the first episode within the last year.
We provide comprehensive and flexible services, including psychotherapy, case management, prescription of psychiatric medications, vocational rehabilitation, and family therapy. We visit individuals and families in their homes if necessary in order to engage people in the program. Psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia can be disabling and devastating to individuals and their families. These illnesses can derail teens and young adults from normative life paths and significantly impair their adjustment to family, work, or school. We find that early and intensive treatment is often extremely helpful in rerouting these young people on a more normative psychosocial path to productive family, work, and school. Getting them on this path sooner and keeping them on that path more reliably than would otherwise happen with individuals who were diagnosed later and provided with less intensive treatment. I have numerous clients I could describe, but I would like to briefly describe one. Jane was a 22-year-old, separated woman, mother of 4 and 6-year-old sons. She was referred by her father and stepmother, with whom she lived temporarily. She was separated from her husband, but in custody of her children due to her severe psychiatric problems. Due to her illness, she thought it was too dangerous to come and see me in the office, but she was willing to talk with me at her home. The first time I saw her, we sat in the living room of her parents' house. She described several bizarre delusions about things growing or implanted in her body and unjustified fears about police and government. On my second visit, I brought with me a psychiatrist who prescribed medications, which she took. By the fifth session, she was willing to come to the office. Eventually, her thinking cleared enough that she and her husband were able to reconcile, and they were able to get out the food stamp program. Our first few meetings were twice weekly in her parents' home. Our intervention helped her to avoid a life of disability and revolving door hospitalizations so common with people plagued with these illnesses. I'm requesting increased funding for East programs in Yamhill County and for Mid-Valley Behavioral Care counties and establishment of East programs in counties statewide. This program only works well with small caseloads. Early identification and intensive treatment can increase the chances of getting people off welfare, avoiding Social Security disability funding, and moving people toward employment and self-sufficiency. These people may not be cured of their disability, but they can be assisted to greatly improve the management of their own psychiatric illnesses. We hope to assist them to return to positive family and work lives, contributing to the community instead of collecting benefits. Finally, increased funding for outpatient mental health in general would allow case managers more time to assist the severely disturbed mentally ill to arrange for all the details of the basics of living with which they have difficulty, but which takes time to arrange, such as transportation, housing, communication with large bureaucratic agencies, such as Social Security Administration and health insurers. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Thank you all of you for being with us today and sharing your testimony and certainly delivery services as well. Thank you. Dr. Nicol, we only have 3 minutes, so I thought you wouldn't want to take up from today, but is there something you're dying to tell us to finish this day? What's your thoughts?
Thank you again, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think the variety of things you heard just now illustrate the kind of topics that we'll be talking about in terms of what the budget holds and where we need to be going. And I do want to comment, too, on Mr. Waters' testimony that we'll do a thorough job of investigating and be happy to report back to you whatever we can report back out of that process. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Are you offering this in lieu of a letter, or what are your thoughts?
Madam Chair, I think the committee should do what it needs to do, and I just wanted to offer my total interest
very
in cooperation.
Very good. And I'm sure the government's people are listening that you've gotten the charge and we'll still just send the letter. Thank you very much. Any last minute words or something like that?
Madam Chair, I would just like to honor all of those who came here with a story to share, information to share, and I mean honor. It takes a great deal of courage to come into a process that is so intimidating, and to speak one's truth. And so I honor the courage and I honor the speaking of the truth and say bless all of you.
Thank you.
Bless you, Tyrone. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much, all of you. Thank you. Thank you.